right, we have three cases this afternoon on our 1:30 docket. We'll proceed at least through two of them, if not three, before we take a break, before the 3 o'clock cases are called. If the clerk will now announce counsel for the first case, West versus North Star. Thank you. Mr. Ward.
Thank you, Your Honor. Is the court ready?
Yes.
Thank you. May I use this for just a moment?
Sure.
Your Honor, what I'd like to do is, if the court will grant me about 3 or 4 minutes, is walk through just a handful of pages that I've taken as excerpts, because they're really the basis of most of the arguments that you're going to do shortly. Back in May of 2004, there was a compromise settlement agreement and mutual release of claims that were executed. This was between North Star Bank of Texas, South Fork Land, South Fork, Northern District West, the West, Business, Valley Business Park Limited, DBP, Jared W. Holmes, Jared W. Commercial Structure Union, Interior CS Management Partners, the COVID. Now, those are redefined down here and again by the same entities, and they are referred to as the Grand Forest for the West entities. And if you'll notice, it specifically refers to the three notes that were outstanding due at that point in time. One was DBP, which is the Valley Park, which is the Valley Business Park, one is JRW, which is the JRW Holdings, and one is CSI, which is Commercial Structure and Interior. And also refers to property that's described here as the property. And I'm not going to read the legal description, but it's specifically set out here. What you then have on the next page of this document is effectively the agreements of parties. And that is, if the West entities agree to convey or cause to be conveyed the bank absolutely and free of any right of redemption or any of the rights or interest in the West properties, all of the land situated in Denton County described in Exhibit A and attached hereto and other improvements now and hereinafter located. The consideration was subject to the satisfaction by the West entities of the conditions contained herein. The bank agrees to accept the conveyance of the properties in full, following complete settlement of any and all claims related to personal liability of the West entities with respect to indebtedness. The West entities agree to convey the properties of the bank in consideration of such accord and satisfaction. The closing date was set as May 27th of 2004, and among the things that were required was, one, the execution of a special warranty deed in lieu of foreclosure, which was attached as Exhibits B and C, and also an assignment of a specific life insurance policy, the Transamerica Life Insurance Policy, with the policy number for a period of 1 year. So it sets out the date, it sets out the property, what's being transferred. Now this, in fact, did occur. As a matter of fact, the special warranty deeds in lieu of foreclosure were executed from South Fork to North Star, and in regard to consideration shown on those, it's pursuant to the compromise and settlement agreement. Again, this is Exhibit D of this. For any consideration and pursuant to the terms of the settlement agreement, granted, bargain, sold, and conveyed. The next one is identical, which is the second piece of property, which was between Valley Park, again, North Star. It contains identical language. In regard to, this is from a compromise and settlement agreement, or in consideration of the compromise, the consideration since the terms of the settlement agreement, grant or conveys, bargain, sold, and convey. These were done, these were executed, these were filed, the real property was transferred. And in fact, in 2004, Valley Business Park, which was one of the landholding entities, the bank, North Star Bank, filed a 1099 showing that the amount of the principal outstanding was $2.6 million and that the value brought to the property was $3.1 million. Now, I've got these in a redacted version, in a smaller version, or like a copy of these. But not only was it transferred, the entities were 1099 in regard to this property. The final judgment in this case, however, finds,
And if you'll notice, the CSI JRW DPE note, that's going to be the same note that we start with back on the first part of this fuel schedule. DDP, JRW CSI notes still have the full principal balance outstanding with accrued interest as of January 23rd, 2008. The notes that were the subject of the settlement agreement, the notes that accumulated in the settlement agreement and the transfer of the real property, which was transferred, 1099 issued on it. And yet the court comes back and finds, thus, the indebtedness as of January 23rd was $2.37 million. So what we have is a settlement agreement, transfer of real estate along with some other items, releases, and yet when this suit starts, and we're about to get into the particulars, the court comes back in final summary judgment and finds that the full amount of the notes are still ruined. No offset, no value given for the properties, nothing. The full amounts are due and owing. Now, that is actually runs into, if you will, issues number two and three. Because what I pointed out in my briefing is a couple of things to the court. Under the Texas Insurance Code, as well as under the Texas, the Texas Finance Code, there was one item which was left outstanding which started this entire suit, and that is a $200,000 life insurance policy. Mr. West passed away in 2007. I'm sorry, in 2006. Now, the terms of this agreement are specific. There's one life insurance, Transamerica, which was assigned for a period of 1 year. Mr. West died almost 2 years after this agreement was executed. That life insurance policy could not have been impacted, and yet Northstar made a claim to it. Part of the original collateral of those three notes was an assignment of a second insurance policy called All America, which was a $200,000 life insurance policy. And that's what started this entire suit, because our position was and is that the settlement agreement signed, releases done, and even if they want to claim that there is an issue in regard to the release, they took the property. They took the property, they sold the property, they issued 1099s on this, and yet they're claiming that there is an indebtedness due and owing. They have to make that claim because otherwise, under both the finance code as well as under the banking code, there is no claim to the $200,000 life insurance policy.
Mr. Ward.
Yes, sir.
Who do you contend are the parties to this appeal?
The only parties to this appeal that we stand before the court today on, I believe, are Joyce West as trustee for the West entities and also Commercial Structures and Interiors. Well, and myself because of the sanction order.
And how, you just showed us over there the first page of the compromise settlement agreement and list a bunch of parties, and I don't read in there that the trust, the family trust, was a party to this agreement.
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
The family trust is who the life insurance policy was payable to.
$750,000 life insurance policy?
And the $200,000.
And the $750,000 was paid to them, right?
Yes.
$200,000 is what was pledged in the bank documents that were already in existence in advance of the time of the settlement agreement.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And in terms of the sale of the real properties?
Yes, Your Honor.
There was a sale of real properties, but my understanding is it disputed on your part that there was an existing lien that had to be paid off out of the proceeds of the sale?
For purposes of clarification, Your Honor, when you say the sale, what happened was a settlement agreement was done, and the bank would have handled the sale of the property because they were given all of the property pursuant to the lease.
I understand what happened. I'm asking you, are you disputing that there was or not a prior lien on the properties that were listed over here as real properties for which there was given deeds in lieu of foreclosure that had to be paid off before the bank realized any money from the sale of those properties?
Okay, now I follow you. Your Honor, therein lies part of the question, because if you look, that's not in the summary judgment evidence. That was part.
What I'm asking, okay, do you dispute or not that there was a lien outstanding that had to be paid off?
The answer to the question is there was land outstanding, and I don't think the land was paid off. Because there's nothing that has been presented either to trial court or even as we stand here today to show a release of that first lien. Now, I will tell you, I do think I know what happened to it. I think the lien was released because if you notice, there's a variance because by their own claims, there was only roughly, I want to say, 1.8 or 1.9 million that would have been due and owing under those notes back in 2004. And yet the 1099 shows 2.6 million. I would guess, and it's a guess because there's never been an affidavit, there's never been an assignment, there's never been a release, there's never been anything presented to the trial court or before this court that shows, one, that that lien was outstanding, two, that the lien was released, that the lien was paid off, or that anything happened to that other lien. Now, I'm surmising, but my surmise is that, yeah, that there was something that happened and that the bank paid some sum of money, and I would guess it would be roughly, I think that comes out to be about $500,000 or $600,000 in regard to the first lien, because that's the only way I can explain the 1099. But you have to understand, I'm guessing, because contrary to what they're now bringing up for the first time on appeal, it's not in the record. They can't show you anything in the record that shows the amount of the first liens as far as what was due and owing on them, that shows that the liens were foreclosed on, that the liens were satisfied, or that anything happened to the liens.
I take it that you're disputing then that there was an existing first lien.
No, I don't dispute that at some point in time there was a first lien existing. What I'm disputing is, one, whether or not they took it subject to that, because, again, I think that the 1099 explains it. But the problem we have is that that wasn't in the summary judgment evidence.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. And I do hope I answered the court's question.
You.
So the reason that, again, that this became important, but even at that point in time, by their own 1099, they got property that after all liens and offsets was worth $500,000 more than what they claimed the liens were, which is, again, substantially more than what the settlement agreement shows that the amount of the liens are on there. So that is a reason that we contend that the court had to make a finding. And if you'll notice, the order doesn't address the first lien. The final judgment doesn't make a finding there was a first lien, doesn't make a finding that there's any amounts due and owing on a first lien, doesn't address a first lien. That was brought up, again, for the first time on appeal on all of this.
Well, how do you get around the language in the document itself, in the settlement agreement, that says it releases personal liability of the West entities, and that definition, by virtue of the agreement itself, includes individuals and corporate entities?
The reason I say that is because you have to have an insurable interest. If they released Mr. West, who the life insurance was on, at that point they didn't have an insurable interest on him anymore. That's a reason that I don't think you get over the first hump of the insurable interest, but even if you do, there cannot be an insurance policy due and owing in which the more typical is that most loans are declining in value in regard to payments made. So if it's a $100,000 loan, you take a $100,000 life insurance policy. As the loan's paid down, if the individual dies, the bank doesn't get the $100,000 under the statute. They get how much is left due and owing on those notes. And if you look at the judgment, we don't know how much is due and owing on the note because according to the judgment, the full face value on the notes are due and owing. And again, this was a summary judgment, so it's I can surmise, but again, it's not in the record, so it's simply be surmising on my part. The first issue that we bring up is a procedural issue in regard to point of error number one, because what happened was we had originally sued the directors. Now, to back up, in regard to the two life insurance policies, demands were made to release the life insurance policies, and in fact, if you take a look at the life insurance policy assignment that's attached to the release agreement, there is a release form that's page two. A demand was made that they sign, execute, and do those as to both policies. There was a refusal to do so. We ended up filing a lawsuit. After the lawsuit was filed, at that point in time, the first policy, the $750,000 policy, was released. The $200,000 was left at issue. Now, since we had sent the demand notices not just to the bank but to the officers and directors of the bank, we also included them as parties in the case. The court granted special exceptions saying we had to replead those causes of action. 1 week, actually I think it was 8 days technically, before the summary judgment hearing, we replayed those issues and filed them. The court conducted the summary judgment hearing not on the replayed issues, which weren't part of the summary judgment, but on the original causes of action which had been pled, which had been subject to special exceptions. And yet the court went ahead and granted the summary judgment and dismissed all causes of action, including the replayed causes of action. The last issue is in regard to the sanctions order that was issued against me. And I'm not going to dwell on that a great deal. I don't think it was fair, but if we get over and above the fair issues, we have a number of procedural issues. One is the motion itself didn't seek sanctions against me. The second problem that we've got is that this was a motion, not only one, but the last two motions that were filed didn't comply with the requirements in regard to certificates of conference. What happened, and I'm going to back up substantially, and it begins actually, I believe, at page 11 of this brief, to say that there were discovery disputes would be akin to saying that the Titanic sprang a leak. This is an issue in which we started out with court-ordered depositions. And when we filed, we asked quickly that we be able to take depositions, ducis tecum, at the start of the case.
Mr. Ward, excuse me, your time is now up.
Okay.
So you'll have to address the rest of that on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And you all are aware that you've requested 15 minutes together, and you're going to take care of dividing the time between yourselves?
We will do so. Thank
you. All right. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Lawson. I'm here with my colleague Bob Bragalone today. I will be addressing all of the issues except sanctions. I can respond in detail to any of the issues, any of the three non-sanctioned claims in the brief. We believe they were very thoroughly covered in our brief. I will not take them one at a time. I'm going to address some of the overarching issues that touch really on all three of them, some of which Mr. Ward has already discussed. And I'm going to use your demonstrative here, Mr. Ward, with your permission. We've got to first think about what this case is really all about. I mean, North Star made a series of very substantial but extremely commonplace commercial loans to entities controlled by John and Joyce West. They were secured by real estate, not just real estate, but other items as well, accounts receivable, life insurance policies, and personal guarantees of the Wests and of the other related entities. Those loans fell into default to the tune of over $2 million. On the eve of foreclosure and financial ruin for the Wests and their related entities because of the very substantial deficiencies involved, which I will get to in a bit, the parties entered into the settlement agreement. Now, the court's prior decision in the CSI case called it the release. We're talking about the same document here. They converted full recourse liability into non-recourse liability, a very common type of settlement to make. In exchange for deeds in lieu of foreclosure and the transfer to North Star of the remaining collateral, the personal liability of the Wests and their entities was released. At heart, this is a claim by plaintiffs that the non-real estate collateral belongs to them. It does not. Now, the settlement agreement in this case did not eliminate the plaintiff's indebtedness. It preserved it. We don't really have a quarrel with Mr. West's description as far as it went, but you'll notice that it stopped before you got to paragraph 5. You don't see any markings there, do you? I know you can't read this, but I assure you that I will read it correctly. And by the way, the sentence I'm about to read you does not appear anywhere in the appellant's brief. It is the intent of the parties that the indebtedness, capital I indebtedness, all of the indebtedness under the loan documents, shall remain in full force and effect and fully secured by the collateral identified in the loan documents. That's not just the real estate. That's all of the collateral. What else does paragraph 5 say? It says that in the event of foreclosure of the deed of trust,
or other enforcement of the collection of the indebtedness with respect to the collateral securing the indebtedness. The bank agrees not to take a deficiency judgment. Again, a further reference to all of the collateral and the survival of the indebtedness. This is the last page that Mr. Ward has included, but it's enough, because down here in paragraph 7, before the next page, it says, and this is the release, the beginning of the release, the first few lines of the release says, subject to the provisions of paragraph 5 of this agreement and the rights of the bank to collect upon the collateral securing the indebtedness effective on the closing date, et cetera, et cetera, and then the release language follows. Another reference to collateral and the indebtedness surviving. Indeed, the title of this paragraph, non-recourse liability of indebtedness. Non-recourse means something to lenders and borrowers. It means there's still some debt, but we're not going to collect it from you, debtor. We're going to take it out of the hide of the collateral. Something else of interest in this rewards demonstrative case. The conveyance documents. And this one he does have highlighted. B, an assignment of a life insurance policy, specifically the Transamerica Life Insurance Company policy. That's brand new.
That had never been granted as collateral before. It makes no sense to grant additional collateral unless the indebtedness survives. And once it is established that the indebtedness survives and that all of the collateral, not just the real estate, but all of the collateral may be applied against it, there is nothing left. There is nothing left of appellant's case. The receivables, the other life insurance policy, the All-America policy, really the only items of collateral at interest in this case belong to North Star.
So wasn't one of the problems, though, that the parties never agreed to a dollar amount value that would be given as credit against the indebtedness when the real property was transferred?
There are two answers to that, Your Honor. The first answer is that the West entities got consideration in the form of the release of the personal liability, that no deficiency would be sought out of their personal assets, and so that the collateral was transferred to us outright. And the amount, the value really did not make any difference. But even if it did, and this is the second part of the answer, even if it did, the value of the collateral, the amount of the indebtedness greatly, greatly exceeded the value of the collateral at issue here. And Mr. Ward spent some time on that, and I'd be happy to elucidate that and give you some record references on that.
Seems to be contradicted by the 1099 the bank provided them.
My next point. The 1099 did have the $3,010,000 figure. But the value of collateral to a lender is the equity, exclusive of prior liens. Now, Mr. Ward has said there's no evidence of the prior liens, nor any evidence that they were satisfied. Not so. The liens were disclosed, the prior liens were disclosed in the loan documents, in the form of warranty deeds and the loan documents themselves, the title information that was entered into at the time, and it's all in the record. Those liens appeared of record at the time the loans were made. It's all in the record. It's all there. As far as the payoff goes, that was related in the affidavit of Judy Leverage, officer of the bank, and it may be found at CR Second Supplement, Volume 2, page 473, paragraph 19. And that's where she talks about the loans that they had to pay off to the tune of over $2.25 million off of that approximately. Actually, the land was probably worth more than the around $3 million, $3.5 million, somewhere in there.
Lawson.
Yes.
On page 12 of the Appellee's brief, there is a summary of the dollar amounts that we're talking about, including the reference that you just made to CR2 Supplement 473, paragraph 19.
Yes.
Those numbers that are there reflect the deficiency amount of remaining after some disposition of collateral is made is either $1,190,345 or $1,707,061. Now, what disposition was made of the collateral? Was it sold and applied against the debt? How was it handled?
The real property?
Yes, sir. The two properties received on the deeds in lieu of foreclosure.
I believe those properties were sold, Your Honor.
Okay.
And again, the prior liens paid off.
Thank you.
Now, we have calculated the total amount of the indebtedness, but that doesn't mean that that is the total amount that is remaining to be paid. And it's still, we're still underwater to the tune of about $500,000. The other point I wanted to make before I yield to Mr. Bragg alone was that the district court's judgment in this case expressly follows the prior decision of this court in the commercial structures and interiors case. That case held that CSI had unambiguously agreed to transfer its receivables to North Star, but that the record before the court did not contain evidence that that transfer had been completed. We agree with that. We agree with that. The court specifically noted that there was to be delivered a notice letter, I'm quoting now, quote, a notice letter to CSI's account debtors, close quote. In footnote 6, the court stated that the settlement agreement states that the form of this letter is attached as Exhibit F, but the copy of the release in the record does not contain such an exhibit. We agree. We fixed that. The record in this case not only contains the form of agreement, it contains the executed letter, executed by John West, which says, this letter is to inform you, this is a letter to the account debtors of CSI, this letter is to inform you that Commercial Structures and Interiors, Inc. has transferred all of its right, title, and interest in and to all accounts receivable and future payments due Commercial Structures and Interiors, and it directs the debtor to pay North Star directly. The district court in this case found that that letter was sufficient evidence to prove that the transfer of the receivables had closed. It was missing in the prior decision of this court. The court specifically found that its decision was in compliance with the Commercial Structures and Interiors case. And I don't know how much time I have left here, but I'd like to give Mr. Bragg alone some time to talk a little bit about the sanctions. Unless there are any further questions on the other three issues, I'd be delighted to address those.
All right, thank you, Mr. Lawson.
Thank you.
Mr. Bragg alone.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. In this case, Mr. Ward and the plaintiffs received an abundance of notice of the motions for sanctions, frankly, more notice than is required under the rules and that you would typically see in any five cases put together. In particular, the trial judge herself noticed the hearing that eventually was set on June 11th with Mr. Ward present in court, confirmed that all of the attorneys would be present for it. And Mr. Ward confirmed that he would be. The original hearing on the first motion for sanctions was set for April 5th. It did not go forward that day, and it was reset to May 15th. And May 15th was the hearing that Mr. Ward attended personally, and Judge Gabriel got confirmation from all the attorneys that she couldn't hear it that day, but that she would hear it on the 11th. Between May 15th and June 11th, we took the deposition of Joyce West, the lead plaintiff. And during that deposition, to put it mildly, irregularities were uncovered, which caused a third motion for sanctions to be filed, including the perjury and the perjurious affidavit of Joyce West. I personally noticed the attorney from Mr. Ward's office who was attending the deposition and handed him the third motion, put it on the record, and said, this too will be set for June 11th. But that wasn't all. We also sent an email, a follow-up, and a fax from two different attorneys who were also serving as local counsel in Denton for the bank. So Mr. Ward in his office received notice from the judge personally. He received notice on the record from me to his associate attending the deposition. He received a fax and he received an email. And all that was confirmed when he emailed Mr. Culp, representing the bank, and asked Mr. Culp if he could move the hearing, to which the reply was no. On top of that, he had counsel who showed up, Mr. Aiden Vickers, and attended the hearing and argued on behalf of what he called the respondent. And it's right there in the record and it's quoted in our brief. He wasn't there representing the plaintiff. He was there representing Mr. Ward, whom he called the respondent. And he quoted, he said at the hearing, and I quote, "Your Honor, there are obviously some very serious charges here today that have been placed before you. Sanctions are never pleasant for anyone to deal with and invariably arise out of the conduct of counsel." He clearly knew what was at issue that day. And Mr. Gannon, Frank Gannon, who was Mr. Ward's associate at the time, personally appeared and defended himself. He clearly knew the seriousness of the sanctions that had been alleged, and he knew that the lawyers, he knew the law, frankly, this court's opinion in Lowe, that the lawyers are always in jeopardy when there is a sanction motions filed, regardless of whether they are named in the title and whether the relief is sought in the prayer. This court's opinion in Lowe and the Supreme Court's opinion in Transamerica, frankly, speak to these very issues, that the lawyers are always in harm's way when it comes to the conduct of a case that they are lead counsel on. And this, in Lowe, it's striking facts because the attorney there didn't attend the sanctions hearing either. He complained that he didn't have a certificate of conference. He complained that he didn't have personal notice that the sanctions were being sought against him. And this court very quickly dismissed all of those arguments based upon the fact that as an attorney, Lowe is charged with the knowledge of the rules of civil procedure, as Mr. Ward is, under Rule 215. And I won't quote the court's opinion back to the court, but it's very clear. In addition, in this case, there was no certificate of a conference required. It was a dispositive motion, and the remedy under the Denton County local rules is to raise it, and it was never raised until 5 months to the day after the sanctions hearing concluded and after the court had announced its ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ward, rebuttal.
Certainly. And, Your Honor, again, I'm not going to dwell on the sanctions because, quite frankly, it is of importance, but I want to get back to the main case. And I would ask three things of this court. Simply take a look at the notices because if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, perhaps we should call it a duck. If you look at the notices that were sent out and that we appeared on and we agreed to the reset zone, they were very limited in regard to what was being argued, and that was a prior deposition. That's the emails, that's the notices, that's the facts. What happens is on a Thursday before a Monday hearing, Mr. Bragalone at a deposition hands off a motion. And mind you, Your Honor, we had already made arrangements for Mr. Vickers to cover me because I had two hearings. I had minors who were being deposed by court order with a associate judge attending them, and I had an injunction order. At that point in time, my understanding when all of this was set was that the issue involved some depositions. Mr. Bragalone unilaterally changed what was happening because he filed a motion 3 days before the hearing, three business days, handed it to Mr. Gannon at the deposition, said, "We're going to have this heard the next week." That was not the court setting that hearing. That was Mr. Bragalone unilaterally substituting the motions that had previously been set for his own motion. And quite frankly, at that point in time, it was too late to do anything. When I'm in a court order deposition and an injunction hearing, with due respect to the court, I'm stuck, and I've got what I've got. And Mr. Vickers did go ahead, and quite frankly, the excerpts that were written were correct because it became very evident very shortly into that hearing that what was being sought was sanctions against me. Just look at the exhibits. Look at the letters. Look at what was filed up until 3 days before the actual sanctions hearing. But let me get back, and I understand what's being alleged in regard to these notes and these settlement agreements. But let me ask a couple of three simple questions. One is, they said that they were in financial ruin, that they were facing foreclosure. Had they been foreclosed upon, the real property at issue, they would have had to have given some valuation to that real property at issue. The problem we have before this court is, according to the court's judgment, the real property, all of the assets that were transferred, have zero value. There's nothing in there saying, okay, there's a $2 million first note and you're owed $1.1 million. There's nothing in this record that says there's a $2 million first note and you're owed $1.7 million. What the judgment says is on its face. It says that the full amounts of those judgments are due and owing. No value given to any of the assets transferred. Their claim is, well, you told us we could do that under the terms of the agreement. If you look at the terms of the agreement, Section 5, that they point out, that section is now covered in the property code in regard to being able to set aside deeds in lieu of. If they had conducted this transaction and a lien appears, an unknown lien, or if the first lien holder, to the extent that it exists, decides to foreclose, they needed an out. They needed to be able to come back and do something. And they built that in. That's now statutorily provided for. But that's...
Mr. Ward, what about the sentence that counsel pointed out to us in paragraph 5 that says it is the intent of the parties that the indebtedness shall remain in full force and effect and fully secured by the collateral identified in the loan documents?
I agree with you. That includes the real property that was transferred, Your Honor.
I'm asking you, that sentence says that the intent of the parties, which we're trying to talk about a contract here.
And I agree with you.
We're trying to look at the intent. And if this is saying that it was the intent that those documents were to remain in effect and that the collateral identified in the loan documents would remain collateral to cover the amount of the indebtedness, is there anything else in the agreement somewhere else that says something different as part to the party's intent? That's what I'm asking you.
I think that what says something different to the party's intent is the fact that they transferred every asset that was owned at that point in time. They transferred the real and the personal property, Your Honor. And the problem we have is that as a matter of law, as a matter of statute, in regard to the life insurance policy, there has to be a deficiency in order to be able to collect those life insurance policies. Not a contractual. The contract is trumped by the statute. Even if you have a contract that says, okay, if you die and the amount of your life insurance policy is in excess of what's owed to us, we get the proceeds, the statute says you don't. Both the finance code and the insurance code say no. That's what the issue is. That's what the issue with this judgment is. This judgment doesn't find a deficiency. This judgment finds that the full value of those notes are due and owing. As a matter of summary judgment, not as a trial issue, not as something that was before a jury for a jury to decide, as a matter of law. I don't think that can stand, but then again, that is a decision that's before this court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. Thank you, gentlemen. Your case is submitted. We appreciate your briefing and arguments today. You all are dismissed.